We are joined live in the studios by Jav Parrish, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Having trouble with your plurals and singulars and conjugations?
Just stringing anything together that's over, you know, 2-3 units long it seems to be a trouble today. So no Maria today. You guys are tag teaming.
Yes, we're hoping she'll be back next week.
We are.
We're hoping I won't be in the hospital next week.
We are?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
We're in the next hour.
Okay. So so we should dive in then.
let's do it.
Just hedge our bets. Okay.
Yep.
So starting out with local and the city council and mayor pushing on SEPA laws.
Yeah, there was a committee hearing this week on a proposal from the mayor and some of her allies on city council to gut SEPA, which is the state environmental protection laws that any project in Seattle has to meet in terms of environmental review before it can go forward. Now, this is one of the few things on the books right now that developers actually have to, check the box on and do that study that can put the kibosh on a project. And as anybody who's been in Seattle for the last few years knows, it's pretty much been the Wild West in terms of developers getting what they want. It used to be that the city would, for instance, stagger projects so that there were not major construction projects across the street from one another so that people had to, detour a whole block as pedestrians. That's gone out the window. A lot of things seem to have gone out the window in terms of neighborhood plans and height limits and those sorts of things. And I guess on the list of things that were pressing concerns in the city, it being too difficult for developers to get their projects through was not really high in anybody's list, but it is high in the developers' list. So what the mayor is doing in this case is claiming that we need to get rid of the SEPA laws because we need developers to be able to build affordable housing and pay into the fund that the city maintains for affordable housing. Because under the HALA guidelines, developers can either build affordable housing in their projects or they can pay into a fund, they're called in lieu of fees, to help the city build affordable housing. Now, the money that the developers are paying into this fund does not actually cover the cost of affordable housing. It's about a 7-to-1 ratio of what housing units cost versus what they're putting in per unit. This is the rationale that the city needs this these in lieu of funds absolutely pronto, got to have it right away. And so they're willing to basically pit environmentalists against affordable housing advocates against environmentalists. And it's a really disturbing kind of tactic. Because you would think that the city this size could actually do both. Selling this as part of the Green New Deal that we're going to get rid of our last remaining environmental review projects for these state requirements, and we're going to substitute for them, city departments having the authority to waive these rules entirely or make up their mind on their own what kind of review is or is not needed. And that process historically has been, as anybody has tried to fight a particular project in a particular neighborhood, these decisions are made long before there's any kind of public process. The cake is baked by the time it gets to any kind of public hearing, et cetera. And basically what you're left with is design review where you can quibble over the size of the awning or the setbacks from the street or these sorts of things, but you cannot question the idea that you're going to have this 25-story behemoth in your residential neighborhood now, this kind of thing. It's a really disturbing kind of tactic that the mayor is trying to push forward here. And the other interesting question is, we've got an election coming up for 7 of the 9 council seats in November, and the Chamber of Commerce has candidates that it has backed in all 7 of those races. In 6 of those races, there are grassroots progressives running against those chamber-backed candidates. And so the election in November is a real referendum on who's going to run the city. And, given the staggering amount of money that the Chambers PAC and some of these other conservative PACs are planning to pour into the general election between now and late October. They're likely to spend in upwards of $1 million on council races, which is an unheard of sum. And they're particularly focusing on District 1, District 2, and District 3. Two of those districts are the two vulnerable progressive incumbents, Lisa Herbold and Shama Sawant. And the third is Tammy Morales, who won with well over 50% of the vote, actually exactly 50% of the vote, in District 2. Those are the folks that the chamber particularly wants to go after. And so the composition of the council may be very different come November, and it may be a majority of business-backed candidates, in which case this kind of developer-friendly measure will be very easy for the mayor to get passed. So the question is, why now? Why make this basically an election issue? And why try and pit environmentalists against affordable housing advocates as you're going into an election? There's some real interesting political questions being raised by the timing of this.
Well, part of that is the two council members that appear to be pushing this forward. Abel Pacheco is the primary person listed on the legislation itself as the sponsor.
Yes.
And Mike O'Brien is also apparently weighed in supporting it.
Yeah, and I'm not sure what O'Brien's deal is. Pacheco, of course, is term limited. He was the temporary replacement for Rob Johnson when he decided he not only didn't want to run for re-election, but he couldn't stand being on council one more minute. And so that will be District 4, which Alex Peterson and Sean Scott are running for. It's a real open question as to why O'Brien is pushing this at this particular moment, other than he may be trying to horse trade for his legislative initiative to try and ban natural gas from new projects for environmental reasons. And that, of course, is something that developers would likely oppose because, in many cases, natural gas is a cheaper form of energy than electric and cheaper to install in their new units. I don't really know what his motivation is for that. Maybe they're doing it in Copenhagen and he decided that that was a good idea.
So the other... or at least one of the organizations that has been pushing this, or is at least delighted with the fact that both the state loosened laws regarding SEPA recently back in February or March, and supposedly these laws that these two are proposing be loosened. This is all appears to be coming from urbanist-based organizations like, let's say, the Sightline Institute.
Right.
Which appears to be that generally that more upzoning is good, more houses will come of this, and that will, and with more houses, the prices will come down and everybody will be happy.
Yeah, this is sort of the Ayn Rand fantasy that I've been hearing for 10 years now, that we'll build more housing and we'll have more affordable housing because the rents will go down. It hasn't worked out that way. And there's no evidence that it's going to work out that way. But the magic marketplace fairy is supposed to sprinkle dust on the Seattle housing market, I guess, and create more affordable housing. I don't think it's going to work that way. And I don't think the years of evidence that we have now support the urbanist position on this. There are a number of ways you can create more density. Giving developers carte blanche to do whatever they want is not one of them. It's basically corporate welfare for developers who don't really need the corporate welfare, but that's how Seattle politics has been working for the last several years. And, it's frustrating because this does not necessarily create affordable housing. The need for affordable housing is far greater in scale than what the private market is willing to address. And the city, obviously with the head tax last year, that was really the last chance that the city had to find a revenue source that could address the scale of the need. They don't really have any options for doing that other than relying on the private market at this point. So in that sense, you'll create more affordable housing, but it's a tiny fraction of what is needed. And the definition of affordable that the city uses is also very, very questionable.
And it still it also seems to spill over into the stances that many of the people who are running for council take, and that, again, the whole upzoning good, you know, and everything else bad. You are a NIMBY if you oppose upzoning. Whereas, again, I don't see people that are necessarily pushing for that having any qualms about the fact that the bulk of the, if not 99.99% of that building that's going to be going in once it's upzoned is going to be controlled by private developers.
Yeah, and the upzoning has gone through for 25 transit-oriented neighborhoods. So what are they pushing there? Are they pushing for upzoning for the rest of the city? I'm not real clear what the debate is about at this point, because nobody's seriously talking about repealing that upzoning. The question is, how is that upzoning implemented? And the historical record is that the city will do as little to try and manage that in a sensible way as they can possibly get away with, because heaven forbid developers might be inconvenienced, and this is another example of that.
So, in the hopefully, just one final thing on this. So, the SEPA laws, the real pushback here appears to be from individuals or organizations appealing these decisions, and that's what it sounds like the Pacheco O'Brien legislation would do is pull the teeth on the appealing process for X.
Yeah, there won't be any appealing process, basically, or it'll be very, very difficult. And as they say, when the track record is that most of these decisions are made behind closed doors long before any kind of public hearing happens, let alone any chance for anybody to appeal, it really underscores the way the city is doing still committed to doing business under Mayor Durkin is get behind closed doors with people with a lot of money. Those are the people who are invited to those kind of meetings, the Amazons and the developers and the Vulcans and all the rest of those folks. And, neighborhood people are not invited.
All right. Anything else on that?
Let's move on.
Okay. Developments this week regarding one of the streetcars.
Yeah, the very troubled First Avenue connector line that's supposed to connect the First Hill streetcar with the South Lake Union streetcar that was pulled earlier this year and then reinstated. Seattle Department of Transportation canceled a $52 million streetcar purchase for that project this week, but insists that the connector itself is going forward. It was originally supposed to be finished by 2018. That's not going to happen. The new completion date is scheduled to be 2026, which will hopefully be in the second term of whoever's elected president next year. It's a long ways away. And the one benefit of that is that the construction has been delayed so long that it gets out of the congestion that's caused by having a major construction project on First Avenue and having the buses on Third Avenue and having the viaduct coming down. You know, that was supposed to all be a maximum cluster, about this time. But because the streetcar has not, the construction hasn't started, and in fact, the cancellation of this contract basically means that SDOT is starting at ground zero with studies. They've canceled the contract that they signed in 2017 for the streetcars. They're starting the contract bidding process all over again. So that's going to add time to the completion date and time to the date by which construction can start, probably not for a couple years at minimum. And, of course, as there are delays in this project, the estimated cost keeps going up and up and up.
And not all the some of that $52 million has already been spent.
Yes,
because they were looking at design and then apparently they discovered one of the reasons they stopped this months back was because they discovered that the cars from this purchase were going to be too big and too heavy.
Yeah, they don't match the two lines, and they were too heavy to go up the hill on first.
So. But again, reading up on it, apparently there was another. There is another company that out there that has stepped forward and said that they can produce the needed streetcars at the original size,
And I was hoping to get a chance to check, and I didn't get a chance to check whether they contributed to Mayor Durkin's re-election campaign.
Well, there's, yeah, but they can contribute in other ways.
That's true.
There are 7 other races currently happening.
Yes, that's true, too, because city council does have to sign off on all this.
All right. All right. Anything else on that?
No, let's move on.
All right. There are developments regarding the Amtrak derailment that happened back in 2017.
Yeah. Down in DuPont, folks may remember that it killed a couple of people, as I recall. It was the first run on that particular track for this train, and there were no signs up for the curve that preceded the train going over a bridge over I-5, so the conductor didn't slow down. So there's definitely some malfeasance there, and the first of what I think are multiple civil cases against Amtrak, a jury awarded $17 million to 3 victims of that crash in 2017, and that sets a precedent for future lawsuits as well. Really an inexcusable malfeasance on behalf of Amtrak.
Yeah, they apparently the new curve that they'd put in, they hit it at about 80 miles an hour.
Yeah, and a little too fast going around the curve. There was a 50s song about that, probably.
Yeah, and killed 3 people and injured more than 60 other people. It was interesting to note the of the 17 million, I believe it was. Oh, I had it down here. Anyway, damn these notes. It's also interesting to note that the Amtrak is limited, is capped in how much damages it can eventually shell out if there's 60 other or 57 other people that could be coming forward with this and various family members. It's capped out at $295 million payouts for single collisions.
That's sweet.
So,
and they've had enough derailments in other parts of the country that I'm sure they've had to consider, what they can afford to pay out, and it becomes a regular budget item.
Well, and all these things are often legislated. The same thing with like the nuclear industry and the nuclear reactors and stuff, and how they vigorously legislated to make sure that in case of an actual nuclear accident in the United States, that it was a very minor amount of money. I think it's actually, if I remember correctly, it's probably less than the $295 million they have for an Amtrak derailment. I think it was around $200 million, and that was like 10 or 20 years ago. So
yeah, but I don't really remember Congress being very good advocates for Amtrak or for travel in general. They really underfund it. So I'm not sure why the cap would be higher here, other than the nuclear industry has better lobbyists.
Well,
and more of them.
All right. Anything else on that? Otherwise, let's go to national. And I understand that you were glued to one of your electronic devices, if not multiple of them, watching the debate that happened this week.
Yeah, there was a third Democratic debate on Thursday. We had a 2-month hiatus since the last one in July. And this one was smaller. Only 10 of the leading Democratic candidates qualified. There are still 20 candidates running. So there are 10 people who are still running who are not on that debate stage. But the 10 who were running generally acquitted themselves pretty well. ABC had this one, and the moderators, much with CNN in July, really seemed committed to trying to get Democratic candidates to attack each other. And just because of the nature of the questions, and honestly, the candidates, with the possible exception of Kamala Harris, were happy to cooperate in this, really didn't mention Trump all that much. They were really focused on trying to tear down each other, and particularly trying to go after Joe Biden and the other leading candidates, Warren and Sanders. And Biden got a lot of airtime on Thursday night. And, he didn't do badly. None of them really did badly. I thought Beto O'Rourke did pretty well. He seems to have found his voice after the El Paso shootings. It's a hell of a way to have to find your voice, but he has. And I thought Cory Booker did reasonably well. Sanders and Warren did reasonably well given their relatively limited opportunities compared to Biden. But I don't think we learned a whole lot from that debate, other than that any of the people up on stage there would be better than Trump. I'm not that thrilled with Biden. He reminds me policy-wise a lot of Bill Clinton in terms of being a very mixed bag, and especially his historical record in the Senate. He's a target-rich environment with his Senate record because there are so many issues, particularly on the foreign policy. He was chair of the Foreign Relations Committee for a number of years, and of course he was a strong advocate being from Delaware for the banking industry, which hardly needed a strong advocate, but he was. So the bankruptcy bill was his baby, making it much more difficult for people to declare bankruptcy. He never met a war he didn't like, including the war in Iraq, and he really hasn't been called out that much on that, although he was called out on that Thursday night for supporting the invasion of Iraq. He would still be better than Trump. Almost any of them would be better than Trump. I don't know about Andrew Yang. He's kind of a mystery box, but most of them would be. It just really underscores that you've got people up there on stage talking about policy and, you know, trying to have serious debates about policy. And meanwhile, you've got a president who could not care less about policy, who doesn't listen to any of his knowledgeable advisors, who does not read any of his intelligence briefings or other background papers. He just tweets, and that's how policy gets made. And we saw that this week with the firing of John Bolton as well, the word looks to be that Trump, having gone through three national security advisors, may not try and hire a fourth. He may leave that position vacant because the position of national security advisor is to try and coordinate all the different agencies that deal with national security and then sort of consolidate their thinking and present the options to the president for, you know, policy decisions. And we know that Trump does not listen to that kind of advice. So why would he want a person whose job it is to provide it? Bolton was a really scary individual in any case, and it really never made much sense politically, because to the extent that Trump has any kind of ideology in foreign policy other than that he likes dictators and he wants to be one himself and he wants to promote himself, he did run in 2016 as something of an isolationist, and Don Bolton is anything but. He's never been a war he didn't like. And he was pushing hard for war against Iran, especially a few months back when we had the little conflagration over an attack on oil tankers in the Persian Gulf, and against North Korea, which didn't go very well because, Donald Trump is in love with Kim Jong-un. So there was a lot of conflict there, and apparently Bolton is out. Not only Bolton, but a lot of the National Security Council staff has also been fired in the wake of Bolton's firing because he stacked it with his own people. And those people are gone now, too. So there's massive number of vacancies in the National Security Council apparatus. It's an open question whether any of those are going to be filled.
Well, he can always bring in, have some of his kids cover a couple of the positions.
Well, the thing is, you got Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump, who are busy jockeying for a position to become president for life in 2028, or 2024, excuse me, or whenever Donald Trump decides to leave office. Trump has dropped any number of hints that he doesn't think he should be limited to two terms. That, of course, assumes that he will be willing to leave peacefully if he doesn't win the election next year. I don't think he will. I think he'll claim the election was rigged and try and stay in office. And we're going to have a real mess when that happens. Literally, Ivanka and Jared have been jockeying for a position to succeed Trump. He wants to have a Trump dynasty in the Oval Office, the way all good dictators do. North Korea is kind of his model there. You had the extreme irony of, a Republican PAC airing an election ad during the, it wasn't even an election ad, during an ad during the Democratic debate attacking Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and comparing her to basically Pol Pot and saying this is what socialism really is. Well,
that was during one of the previous debates.
No, that was this week.
Did they run it again this week?
Yeah, they ran it this week.
Okay.
With her face on fire and the whole bit.
Okay. That had previously come up prior, so they're getting more mileage out of it.
Yeah, and, you know, the trope of, you know, socialism equals bad is something that they're going to keep hammering on, but it's really hard to make that case when, you know, Trump's fondest ally in the world seems to be Kim Jong-un, which is the one remaining communist dictatorship in the world. If you don't include China as a dictatorship, because they are technically communist, although, you know, as an economic system, they seem much more capitalist than communist these days. But you know, he also has a lot of admiration for President for Life Xi. So you know, it's hard to make the case that Republicans are anti-communist when they're Trump's party, and Trump himself seems to love communists. But he likes the dictator part more than he cares about the communism.
So it seemed like on social media, sticking with talking about the debate, that most of the reviews were about Joe Biden and his trouble with conveying thoughts. So kind of like what I'm doing
yeah,
now.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it happens when we get up there in years, right? But I really thought that Julian Castro's attempt to imply that Joe Biden was too old because he couldn't remember stuff or was having trouble articulating backfired on him, on Castro. There's no real evidence that the various, we'll call them gaffes, that Biden does on the campaign trail or in these debates are hurting him at all in the polls. He's right where he was, 6 months ago before the debate started and before people began campaigning in earnest. He still has a fairly commanding lead in most of the polls, and particularly in among African Americans and in states where that block of voters, particularly South Carolina in the early primary states, are important. He has a huge lead, and it doesn't seem to be eroding at all. It was interesting in the debate how many people were bending over backwards to praise President Obama. I think that's the latest tactic because they've looked at the polls and seen that Obama at this point has huge favorability ratings among Americans because he looks really good by comparison with the president, White House occupant. But, virtually every candidate up there on stage was praising Obama at some point or another. And there's plenty to be, particularly for progressives, plenty to be critical of Obama about in foreign policy and in domestic policy. He was a traditional president in terms of being rational and listening to advisors, and he was remarkably scandal-free during 8 years, again, in stark contrast to the current occupant. But there's plenty to be critical of him about, but nobody dares say that because they're looking at the polls.
So it also seemed to be a lot of, as you pointed out, set up to tear each other to pieces. Healthcare packages were a big thing early on in this particular debate.
Yeah, and really you're, to the extent that there are significant differences, particularly between Warren and Sanders, who basically want a version of Medicare for All, and other candidates who want more incremental approaches, that to me seems less of an important distinction when you've got a court case right now that could void the Affordable Care Act entirely and put 130 some million Americans with pre-existing conditions out of their insurance. Along with, all the people who were able to get insurance through Obamacare, which is a significant number. It's not all Americans, but it's a significant number. And the Medicaid expansions and all the rest of it. Given that may happen before the election next year, I think you're going to see a very different debate going forward into the primaries and into the general election once that court case is decided. So at this point, it seems it seems a little premature to be talking about that, because you're talking about what would be ideal, and you may be about to go to a very, very bad system that was, you know, the pre-Obamacare system of 10 years ago. Only insurance companies are even richer and more powerful now, and less inclined to insure sick people.
Yeah, but it seems like it's one of those issues that actually resonates with most people.
Oh, sure, healthcare. It does. Sure, it does. But I don't think most people understand that, you know, it's not just a question of building on what we have now. It's preserving what we have now, and then build on it, that we may lose what we have now, as inadequate as it might be. And, you know, certainly I think Sanders and Warren make a compelling case in terms of the need that Medicare for All would make a lot of sense. It's less expensive for patients, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it's to me, it's debating the ideal, what would be ideal, and it helps communicate the values of individual candidates. But as with some of these other proposals, you've got to get it through Congress, and that's why control of the Senate is going to be so important this coming year. There are several states where Republicans are vulnerable that Democrats might be able to flip, including two in Georgia that are up for re-election, and also Arizona and Maine and Colorado and probably a couple others I'm forgetting. The Democrats would need to flip three if they have the White House, four if they don't, to get control of the Senate. And otherwise, Mitch McConnell is not going to allow anything through. And whoever is president has to do everything by executive order, which, to her credit, Elizabeth Warren has been very clear that a lot of what she wants to do, she's relying on executive orders to do it. She's not relying on Congress. That seems very smart and politically savvy.
But in terms of what then they should be covering for policies, I mean, that affects everything is going to be impacted by the current people in the Senate and in Congress.
Sure. And the same thing is true of climate change and some of these other critical issues where you know, some of the candidates, and it was interesting to see Jay Inslee name-checked by one of the candidates Thursday night, because he really did push other Democratic candidates to up their climate change plans. And some of them are very good now. You still have to match the scale of the crisis, you know, you have to spend a huge amount of money, and that has to go through Congress. You can't just transfer it out of the military the way Trump has been doing with his precious border wall.
I think maybe you, apparently, if he can do it, perhaps they can do it.
Well, that's one of the dangers that Trump is doing, is setting a precedent for future presidents who might be inclined to want to be authoritarian, but might be smarter about it than Trump is. Because he's also breathtakingly incompetent and lazy. He is shattering norms and setting precedents that a future president can take advantage of, particularly when you get Supreme Court rulings like the one this week on asylum seekers that basically side with the president. You've got a conservative Supreme Court now that may be may have a conservative majority for a couple decades to come. It's very frightening.
Yeah. Again, and this is all as bad as Trump is and appears. I mean, this has all been built up on all these previous people in office and elections.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I can remember saying the same thing about George Bush, that, you know, his lying and his executive actions and those of Cheney were setting the precedent for future presidents. And, you know, Obama didn't roll back on any of those. He took advantage of them. And now Trump is pushing the envelope that much further.
And we,
because once those checks and balances go away, they don't come back, generally speaking.
And we talked about this during the Obama administration, how a semi-regular theme was, why aren't people, while you have this window of having, you know, houses supporting some support of the president and a relatively better president than average, which isn't setting the bar very high here. why the heck people aren't out pushing their elected officials towards making some serious changes.
Well, the reality is that progressives tend to be much more active when there's a Republican president. And they kind of went to sleep for 8 years, Occupy notwithstanding, because Occupy didn't really result in any major structural changes. It resulted in some great memes, and it gave us the vocabulary of the 1% and the 99%, but it didn't really materially affect policies. We literally have a lot of the same banking policies in effect that we had before the crash in 08. And, you know, this is one of the progressive arguments against Clinton in 2016 was that, no, she's not as bad as Trump on policies, but she's not going to get any pushback if she's president, whereas Trump will get pushback. And that makes her more dangerous, especially on foreign policy. And there's some truth to that. I think I didn't agree with it because I thought Trump was really that bad. And I feel pretty sadly vindicated in that assessment. But that was the argument against Clinton, and I understood it. And, you know, we have the same danger if we get a President Biden next year. And hopefully we'll have learned that lesson, but we'll find out, I hope.
And as others have pointed out, while everyone is focusing on the presidential race, you know, there are these other races that are going to be happening at the same time that are probably far more critical in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and it's not just the U.S. Senate. It's also the control of state legislative houses, because a lot of states, unlike Washington, the state legislature determines the districting from the 2020 census. And so the kind of gerrymandering that the Supreme Court, again under Trump, has ruled is now legal, that really baked the cake for Republicans for the last decade in terms of the House of Representatives, where you had, in terms of total vote cast, Democratic majorities countrywide in a system where it's not an electoral college. It's supposed to be one person, one vote. And, you know, if you have a majority in a district, you elect the congressperson from that district. So for the House of Representatives, Democrats would win more votes across the country, but because of gerrymandering, Republicans had majorities up until last year. That danger for the next decade is that if Democrats are too focused on the Senate and on the federal races and on the presidency and don't pay enough attention to these state house races, especially in swing states like, you know, Arizona, North Carolina, et cetera, you're going to wind up with these extreme gerrymanderings again for the next decade. And that's going to make it that much more difficult for Democrats to hold on to their House of Representatives. We're just full of good news today, aren't we?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we didn't include any good news items today either. all right, House Judiciary Committee dealing with the impeachment.
Yeah, well, there's your good news. They had a hearing on Thursday in which they approved rulemaking for an impeachment inquiry. The trick to this, of course, is that the Democratic leadership, particularly Speaker Pelosi, doesn't want to call it an impeachment hearing. But the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, Jerry Nadler, has been very upfront that that's exactly what it is, and that's what his members on this committee are calling it as well. They are saying that they want to have a recommendation, pro or con, on moving forward with impeachment by the end of the year. Now, whether Speaker Pelosi would move forward with that recommendation is anybody's guess, particularly during an election year. But it does need to be investigated, and we'll find out what the investigations lead. Of course, the investigations have been that much more difficult by the complete lack of cooperation and lack of responsiveness to subpoenas by the Trump administration. I think there's something like 63 different lawsuits underway now because of that, and some of those are starting to get heard by lower courts and moving their way up the courts. And that's going to take through next year to resolve as well. But hopefully they can get enough witnesses and enough material witnesses that they can come to some conclusions, especially on some of these things that seem pretty open shut, like the emoluments clause, where Trump is literally enriching himself through the presidency or trying to enrich himself through the presidency.
And again, the process of doing the investigations will be a good thing, regardless of whether they decide yes or no on impeachment proceedings.
Yes, and it also, for some technical reasons, has advantages for the court cases that are being heard, that the Judiciary Committee thus has more standing and more latitude to demand documents and witnesses, et cetera, if it's an impeachment investigation as opposed to a quote-unquote ordinary investigation as part of the House oversight function. It's a more serious level.
So it is a good thing that this is moving forward regardless. There is
There's a question. I mean, one of the advantages of an actual impeachment inquiry is that you get to make the case to the American people about what has gone wrong. And the concern at this point is that people are so numbed by Trump's constant lawbreaking and you know, domination of the daily news cycle that that the Mueller investigation dragging on and the Democrats in the House dragging on this year, that it may not have the impact that it should, and people may not be paying attention the way they should. And that's going to be even more of an issue as the primaries get closer and so forth for the election next year.
All right. Moving on, New York City is granting their students permission next week to skip class.
Yeah. Next Friday across the country, I think it's a global event, there will be a climate strike. It's being led by youth and people in schools across the country will be going out on strike to demand action on climate change. That includes here in Seattle, and we'll give details on that at the end of the show with events. There's a couple major marches and events coming up at the end of next week. New York City, the nation's largest school district, said, yeah, if you got permission from your parents, you can skip on out in class and good on you. Mayor de Blasio, of course, is one of those 20 Democrats running for president. And so he's trying to make himself look good on climate change. But, beyond that, it was really the school district's decision. And good for them, because that means a whole lot of students will be out. And I believe there's going to be a major rally in Washington Park in Lower Manhattan for Elizabeth Warren on Monday. So there's going to be a lot of mobilization in New York City this week. That rally looks like it will eclipse Seattle for the record crowd size for Warren for a presidential campaign.
Well, and of course, Greta Thunberg is in the U.S. currently.
Yes.
She's a big...
She's become something of a rock star.
She has.
And good for her.
I would, say she has a bright future, but it's not exactly the future we would necessarily wish on anyone.
That's why she's in this country to begin with. Yes.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. Immigration updates.
Yeah, a bunch of immigration updates this week. Speaking of hearings in the House, there was a hearing on Wednesday, and we talked about this really for the last month. The Trump administration's decision to issue an order canceling a medical deferment program that allowed non-citizen kids with seriously ill diseases to receive treatment in the United States. So they started getting letters in the middle of August saying, you and your family have 33 days to leave the country. This is basically a death warrant for a lot of these kids, people with cystic fibrosis, rare heart diseases, et cetera, where if they come from someplace like Guatemala or Honduras, they do not have treatment for those illnesses in their home programs. And not only that, but, by definition of rare diseases, there aren't that many people with these diseases, and they've been important in terms of researchers being able to find treatments for these diseases, because by definition of rare, there aren't that many kids with these diseases, and they needed larger sample sizes. It wasn't entirely altruistic why these kids were in the United States in the first place, but it has kept them alive. And the Trump administration has basically signed death warrants for these kids. So there was a House hearing on Wednesday talking about this, because Democrats wanted to know, what the heck, because the Trump administration, it's not entirely clear who issued this order. There was no formal announcement of it. The letters just started appearing. And then we started finding out through local media in places like Boston and Miami and San Francisco, covering the families getting these letters and having to leave the country. And so their representatives started demanding a hearing in Congress, and that happened on Wednesday. The Republican position on this seems to be, oh, you're making this up. Why aren't we talking about all the drug dealers that we need to deport instead? This isn't really happening. You're just trying to make Trump look bad. This would have been more effective had some of those kids not been in attendance waiting to testify under oath that they're being sentenced to death, which they did. And it was really heartbreaking to watch. I recommend people going and taking a look at some of that footage on C-SPAN. The really revealing part was somebody from, I believe it was HSD, being asked, well, you know, who in ICE authorized this? How many families are affected? How many people are being deported? What's the rationale for canceling this program? Why is this a security risk? Kids with cystic fibrosis generally are not out breaking the law. The representative from HSD wouldn't answer any of those questions because, well, I can't answer any of that because under the advice of my lawyer, we're facing lawsuits. And so one of the Democratic lawmakers said, well, okay, so you can't answer those questions. Do you know the answers to these questions? Well, I'm sure I could get them if I had some time to prepare. You had time to prepare for this hearing, sir. Do you know the answer to any of these questions? And he didn't, of course. And so it's really a black box. It's not clear why the Trump administration is sentencing these kids to death. They kind of tried to walk back the policy a couple of weeks ago by saying, well, families can apply for exemptions to these deportation orders, but it's not clear where they apply for these exemptions or what agency would hear them or whether they have any chance of being granted. And meanwhile, the 33 days they were originally given in several of these cases, that's up today. So it's not entirely clear whether people are staying in this country illegally or whether they're being deported. It's really a incredibly tragic turn of events. And as with the Trump administration in general, the cruelty is always the point. But in this case, it's not just cruelty. It's premeditated homicide. It really is, because these kids will not survive without the treatment that they're receiving. Speaking of the cruelty being the point, the Border Patrol also came out with regulations this week for refugees from the Bahamas, which, of course, was totally flattened 2 weeks ago by Hurricane Dorian. You'll be glad to know that the United States will be happy to receive refugees from the Bahamas if they have a valid visa to enter the United States. Well, it's kind of difficult to obtain that visa since the U.S. Embassy in the Bahamas was flattened, and it was in Nassau, which is the capital of the Bahamas, which is very difficult to get from the more heavily affected islands in the north of the country because the airstrips are out. So, logistically, it's almost impossible to get one of those visas, assuming they would be granted in the first place. So basically what Border Protection is saying is we're not going to accept any refugees. And as I said, the cruelty is the point, but racism is never far behind. The Bahamans who were affected by the hurricane are largely black. Of course, the kids being deported with serious illnesses are largely Latino. This seems to be the new norm for the Trump administration. Find any way you can to keep people out or to kick people out, regardless of the consequences and regardless of whether people are actually dying. And this was the other piece of the immigration update, was the Supreme Court ruling that the Trump administration's policy that basically abolishes the asylum system for people trying to enter the United States, that was legal somehow. I'm not entirely sure what the rationale for that was, other than that the executive branch has the authority to change that policy. But the consequences, particularly for people fleeing deadly circumstances in Central America, where the Trump administration has also cut off humanitarian aid, which might have helped ameliorate that, You know, they're coming here because they're desperate, because they are afraid that they won't survive if they stay where they are. You can't have enough cruelty to offset the threat of death. And that's what people, the Trump administration is trying to condemn people to consistently across the board now.
And fleeing conditions that the U.S. had a significant hand in.
Oh, absolutely. The regimes in those countries are all regimes that, and we're talking specifically about Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala. You know, Honduras, there was a coup about a decade ago that the United States supported. And that is, that's the country where the violence is really off the charts. In other parts of Central America, there's a severe drought because of climate change. And, you know, they're fleeing economic conditions that are impossible because they're sustenance farmers and you can't subsist when the crops won't grow because there's no rain and there's no water. So, you know, in all of these cases, they're fleeing desperate circumstances. And, you know, where they're going to flee is anybody's guess at this point.
Sorry, you remind me of something that I had seen this week that I got to squeeze in. So I don't know if you caught it, but I believe Newsweek was the original source for breaking the news on it. But apparently ICE had failed to redact in one of its requests for money for a facility, a training facility that specializes was going to specialize in building a highly realistic village, one facility depicting Chicago, like a downtown Chicago layout, and another being Arizona, and each one made up of like dozens, if I think one was up to 50 buildings, so that they could do combat training and, you know, dealing with different situations that ICE apparently thinks they're going to have to deal with in the future years, future decades. And the location that they had for this was actually that it's going to be built at Fort Benning, which, as you know, has a rich history tied to Central America.
School of the Americas, yes.
So just surreal. Continuation of building on former policies and decisions.
And this underscores the concern that I have if Trump somehow manages to stay in office. I won't say reelected because who knows whether the election next year will be legitimate or not. But if Trump stays in office for another 4 years, I think it will be the end of democracy in this country. I really do. I think that by the end of 8 years of Trump, democratic institutions will be sufficiently eroded that we will no longer have anything resembling what we think of as democracy in this country. And it was never, you know, it was always an ideal that we didn't live up to in the first place. But it can and very well might get much, much worse.
Yeah. Didn't some people call it the democratic experiment?
Yeah, exactly.
So time to pour the...
Time to demand the
chlorine or whatever on the
dish. Time to demand that we want actual democracy and not this.
All right. Just under 5 minutes left, and we got some events that we want to make sure we include. But Ukraine gets some funding this week.
Yeah.
Some funds released.
So when Russia invaded Crimea in 2014, the Obama administration did several things to punish Russia for that invasion. One, of course, was kicking Russia, leading the charge to kick Russia out of the G8, so it became the G7. And, of course, we saw Trump last month trying to push behind the scenes to get Russia back into the G7, which didn't go very far. We had military assistance to the Ukraine to combat the civil war that Russia was basically, and ethnic Russians were fighting in the east of Ukraine with the assistance of the Russian military. U.S. was giving military aid to its NATO ally, Ukraine, to try and offset the Russian presence in Ukraine. That funding was being held up last year by the Trump administration, and it was scheduled to expire at the end of this month. The House Democrats decided to schedule a hearing on why that funding was being held up. And lo and behold, the Trump administration caved this week and released the funding for the Ukraine. but that was something the Russia, that Trump administration was trying to do also. Then the third thing that the United States did was something called the European Reassurance Initiative. Now that was a bunch of money that was sent to, for instance, countries in the Baltic states that were fearing of a Russian invasion, similar to what happened with Crimea, so that they had better defenses and could potentially withstand a Russian invasion. And that that oddly enough, that program got the bulk of the overseas diversions from military spending to Trump's border wall this past month, where Trump tried to divert, has diverted over $3 billion, that's B, billion dollars, to his precious border wall from various military projects, including daycares and schools in the United States, but also including overseas, mostly cuts to programs that would help offset potential Russian military incursions. And then we had a bunch of we had a bunch of reporting this week about a U.S. intelligence asset who was placed high in the Kremlin, who was able to verify in real time for the Obama administration that it was Vladimir Putin specifically who ordered the interference in the U.S. elections in 2016. That asset was pulled out of the Kremlin and relocated in the United States in 2017, in large part because the CIA feared that Donald Trump would leak his identity to Vladimir Putin. But this week, for some reason, a whole bunch of different media outlets, CNN, The Wall Street Journal, NBC, The New York Times, had a bunch of information on this guy, including linking his name and his home address in Virginia. So he's has been disappeared again, because we also had, or have brewing, something that happened 3 weeks ago in downtown Berlin, not too far from the headquarters of the Russian government, German government, another assassination of a Russian dissident. This is a former Chechen military commander that a Russian national literally shot and German police for various reasons managed to apprehend him very quickly. But he shot the guy in the head in the middle of a park in the middle of the day in broad daylight. And this, again, similar to the attempted assassination of a couple Russian dissident and his daughter in Britain last year, is Russians assassinating dissidents in Western countries. And it raises the specter of they're targeting this guy who the U.S. extracted in 2017. And for some reason, all the information on him leaked to the media this week. It's a really kind of surreal John le Carre kind of thing that we're seeing play out in real time. But the constant in all of these, administration actions, is that they all benefit Vladimir Putin. And you know, it's anybody's guess why Donald Trump is so beholden to Putin, but that's something I think we'd all love to know.
Events.
Yeah. Coming up tomorrow, Dispatches from the People's Struggle, a report back from the June meeting of the International League of People's Struggle. That meeting was in Hong Kong, which has some important lessons for activists anywhere. That will be down in Tacoma at the Fab 5 HQ. This is in a neighborhood that has a lot of labor offices, so I think that's what this might be. It's 1120 South L Street in Tacoma, and I believe on the 25th there will be a similar meeting in Seattle, so we'll talk about that next week. On Monday, Premal Jayapal is having her annual Build Our America dinner with a keynote, Andrew Gillum, the Democratic nominee who almost won the Florida governorship last year. He's a very articulate and compelling dude. I highly recommend it. It'll be at the Westin Hotel, 5th and Westlake in downtown Seattle. And then on Friday, as we talked about earlier, the Seattle climate strike will be happening. It'll be from 9 to 12:30 on Friday. There will be a Climate Justice Fest at Cal Anderson Park. That's on Capitol Hill at 11th and Pine. And then from 12:30 to 3, there will be a march to City Hall. There will also be a feeder march of Amazon and tech workers from 11:30 to 1, and then leaving at 1 o'clock from the Spheres at 7th and Lenora. That will also be heading to City Hall. So this should be a big deal. So if anybody can take off work Friday, join the climate strike, I highly recommend you do. It is youth-led, but it's hardly limited to youth. It will be everyone.
Yeah.
It'd be a big deal.
I was reading last week where, there was several hundred Amazon employees who were protesting Amazon's stance and lack of taking any meaningful stance on saving the original Amazon and things like that. So they're going
right.
to be, as you pointed out, they're going to be part of that. So
that's awesome. And I think Whole Foods workers might have a beef now, too.
Yeah, as if they didn't have one already.
Yep.
And for those that aren't following, Whole Foods was bought by Jeff Bezos. So.
Yep.
All right. Well, we will plan on seeing you here then next week.
That sounds like a great plan.
Okay.